Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three is Dream Warriors, and four has Drago. Wait. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Back to Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Reject's weekly cults and exploitation film podcast that always strives to be your teddy bear, if not at least your huckleberry. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, the king of schlock and droll, and normally I would be joined by Mr. C. Robert Cargill, but he is on assignment this week. He's researching his upcoming book on roller disco etiquette. I believe it's called Xanadu's and Don'ts. So therefore, filling in, we have a very special guest host. He is the author of the column Culture Warrior right here on FSR, Mr. Landon Palmer.
Hi, Brian.
How's it going, Landon?
Doing well. I prefer to Xanadon't when given those two options.
When the two options are presented, I prefer to Xanadon't. I'm a rebel that way.
It's a good segue, though, since we're talking about the best musicals, rock, pop musicals ever made.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, it's funny. Soon I'll have to refer to you as Dr. Landon Palmer.
Not so soon.
soon enough. So way sooner than most of us will ever get to being a doctor. We'll get into that more in just a moment. I do want to remind you guys that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes. If you just search for Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section, you can also find us on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com, you guessed it, / Junk Food Cinema. And all the movies we're going to talk about today, there's going to be little Amazon links at the bottom of the page. If you want to go ahead and click on those links, no matter whether you buy that item or anything else, as long as you get to Amazon via those links, it actually does support the show, and we appreciate it. So, the once and future Dr. Palmer, you are you're getting your doctorate in film, and you have a rather interesting subject for your dissertation.
Yes, I'm writing a dissertation on rock and roll movies of the 50s and into the early 1980s. I'm not really looking at a complete comprehensive history of rock and roll movies, but I'm more dividing my chapters by looking at several different rock stars or rock and roll film styles in each chapter and just kind of seeing how the rock and roll movie changed throughout this period.
Right. And obviously you can't talk about rock and roll movies, and especially since your dissertation starts in the 50s, without talking about Elvis.
Of course.
That's kind of what we're here to talk about today is the king on film.
Yes. I'm going to spend my first chapter talking about Elvis because I can't really talk about anything in terms of rock music history without starting with and making sense of Elvis Presley, because everything, as I found out more and more, everything seems to positively or negatively be kind of a reaction to what Elvis kind of made the rock movie into.
Sure. So, I mean, he has a very direct impact on the scope of cinema, especially pop cinema in the 50s, whether you are a fan of his acting prowess or not.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, when the Beatles made Hard Day's Night, John Lennon says something along the lines of, "We don't want to make another crappy rock and roll movie," and a lot of people interpreted him as talking indirectly about Elvis movies themselves, specifically because those were, at that time, the most lucrative and the most frequent of rock and roll movies.
I gotcha. So let's start at the beginning, as these things often do. Which was Elvis's first movie?
Elvis's first movie is Love Me Tender.
Okay, because I always mistakenly think that it's Jailhouse Rock, because that's the one I feel like is the first like big breakout pop culture phenomenon movie, but Love Me Tender is actually his first movie.
Yeah, and because of the enduring popularity of Jailhouse Rock, it kind of gets lost to history how big of a deal Love Me Tender was. Mm-hmm. It was a very big deal when it came out, but it's also a really strange film, and a really strange film for Elvis to make his debut as well. He's the third billed star in the film.
Huh.
Yet he was promoted as the primary star of the film. The film was originally called The Reno Brothers, and it was about the Reno Brothers, these rural Missouri outlaws at the during the tail end of the Civil War. And one of their brothers in this imagining of history just so happens to play rock and roll very well and very anachronistically in 1865 Missouri.
Right, where rock and roll had not quite made it across the Mason-Dixon line or, you know, into this temporal environment.
Michael J. Fox had yet to go back in time to...
Your kids are going to love it. Your great-great-grandkids are going to love it.
Well, and I mean, there are a lot of really interesting and odd things about this movie, but this movie was incredibly popular when it came out. The title track "Love Me Tender," which the film was retitled to several weeks before it was released, was the biggest selling single record to date at that period in time.
Oh wow!
And so it became very, very evident to people at Fox and Paramount, the two places where he was mainly making movies during this early period in his history, that there was a really nice opportunity for synergy in Elvis in terms of both promoting Elvis movies and rock and roll songs at the same time.
Huh. So, okay, so Love Me Tender kind of gets things started. It's funny, growing up, I saw a lot of Elvis movies sort of in passing or in snippets because my mother and my grandmother are both huge Elvis fans. I like to tell people that I've been to Graceland as many times as I've been to Disney World, and I've been to Disney World a lot. Like, it used to be this pilgrimage we would make every so often, like, to the point that I started to notice changes in the house when, like, the tour would change or certain rooms would no longer become available. I noticed. Mm-hmm. And it's such a weird thing for a little kid, like, of my generation to be like, oh, yeah, the jungle room is where... And I'm like, why do I know anything about the jungle room? Why do I know these things? And it's just because... I've seen the inside of his plane. I've seen his various vehicles that he owns, and it's a really weird thing that he is almost deified to this day. So it's interesting to go back and look at these films that were just another way to kind of. I mean, Eddie Murphy has that great bit in Delirious where he talks about how all the Elvis movies are the same, mm-hmm. about how they're all just excuses to get Elvis to sing. So it's like, Elvis, you're a race car driver. We got to win this race. And it's like, no matter what it is, no matter what the situation, he is always going to be singing something. But I'm getting the sense from talking to you about this that it was a little bit more complicated than that. And like you said, it really did affect the way pop cinema was shaped for the next 20 years or so.
It was a bit more complicated than that. And it's easy to look at Elvis's filmography as a whole and to get that impression because he made 31 films between 1956 and 1969.
That's crazy.
That is an insane amount of films. Yeah. And so just for that, from that proliferation alone, like I have some friends who are like you, have grown up with parents who were fans of Elvis and other friends whose parents knew who Elvis was, but they weren't particularly necessarily Elvis devotees.
Right.
But, you know, growing up when we did and watching a lot of cable, these films got a lot, have had a lot of circulation on cable mm-hmm. within the past 30, 40 years. And so what's interesting about this is that these films kind of become a hodgepodge,
right?
When you watch them outside of their historical order.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go back and look, and I think especially if you look at the films that he made between 1956 and 1961, he made eight films in that period. And those films were really the kind of trying and testing area that allowed an Elvis formula to eventually take hold. And that Elvis formula would continue him through the 60s before he switched from the silver screen to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And he would make up to about three films a year. And that basically became his career. He arguably had a longer career as a film actor than he did as a stage performer.
Mm-hmm.
Because at one point towards the early 1960s, he stopped performing. He stopped touring altogether and instead just kind of got into this endless cycle of making a few films a year. And those film soundtracks would be his studio albums that he would release each year.
Huh. So he would subsist entirely, you know, not even financially, but creatively. His creative output would just be, as a musician, the soundtracks for the movies that he was in.
Eventually, yeah. Huh. So basically the space in which Elvis was in the movie studio and the recording studio, back and forth. And so even though Elvis movies have this kind of lower place in regards to his career as a whole, even amongst Elvis fans. Many Elvis fans might consider his films to be to have constricted him as an artist, and there's a case to be made there. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to recognize how essential these films were to Elvis's fame.
Sure. And you know, you talk about this period starting in 1955. So let's focus on this period for a minute. So these eight films you're talking about, this is where we get films like Jailhouse Rock, correct?
Yes.
And also one of, you know, probably my favorite of all the Elvis movies, which is King Creole.
His favorite too.
Yeah. It's that one movie that, you know, when I hear people talk about, you know, the Elvis model and all Elvis movies are the same, there's merit in that. But I also point them to King Creole as being a decidedly darker and edgier film for Elvis, and something that was never really replicated again.
Yeah, and what you have in these early Elvis films is this tension between who Elvis wants to be as a movie star, mm-hmm. and who the movie studios and Colonel Tom Parker want him to be, mm-hmm. as somebody who makes corporations a lot of money.
Right.
And so what you have there is this tension that's really on display in a film like King Creole, where he wants to be this kind of 50s rebel method actor type. He really looked up to Marlon Brando and especially to James Dean. And some of his first auditions for Paramount, because this Paramount producer named Hal Wallace was the first person who tried to kind of form Elvis from a rock star into a movie star. And his first screen tests are not of him playing music, but of him reciting lines that Burt Lancaster said in this movie called The Rainmaker.
Really?
That came out around that time. Yeah. And so at the beginning, there is this seriousness. There are these like glimpses of seriousness with which movie studio executives took Elvis as a potential serious actor.
Sure.
And you can see glimpses of that in darker movies and more pedigreed movies like King Creole, which was directed by Michael Curtiz of Casablanca.
Yeah.
Or a movie like Wild in the Country, which was written by Clifford Odets, who wrote Sweet Smells of Success.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Or Flaming Star, which is directed by Don Siegel, who had done Invasion of the Body Snatchers and would later do Dirty Harry.
Don Siegel, who is one of the most respected, you know, American filmmakers, you know, in the pantheon of American filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, this interesting thing about Michael Curtiz as well is that movie, you know, you mentioned how much Elvis looked up to James Dean. And King Creole, if I'm not mistaken, was a movie that was intended for James Dean.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. Then they had to recast after his death.
Yeah, and there are actually quite a few movies that Elvis ended up not getting cast in for reasons that I don't quite know. I would imagine it came from pressure from his management, so or somewhere in within the line of people calling the shots who were not Elvis himself. There's this movie starring Robert Mitchum.
One of my favorite actors.
Yes, called Thunder Road.
Really?
Yes.
Elvis was supposed to be in Thunder Road.
Yeah, Elvis was supposed to be the younger character in Thunder Road.
Wow.
And he was supposed to star opposite Robert Mitchum in Thunder Road.
Man, that is a missed opportunity for the universe.
It really is. And it was Robert Mitchum who went to bat for him. It was Robert Mitchum who seriously wanted Elvis to co-star in a movie with him. And, you know, Robert Mitchum is arguably part of the generation prior to James Dean of these kind of rebel bad boys in Hollywood genre movies. So you can kind of see if history turning out slightly differently for Elvis movies.
Yeah.
But what happened was that after he came back from the army in 1960, he starred in four movies between 1960 and 1961. And these four movies, I think, really illustrate the tensions between what Elvis wanted to be and what he was made to be, dependent upon what audiences actually went to see, and perhaps more importantly, which records sold the most. These four movies were G.I. Blues, Flaming Star, Wild in the Country, and Blue Hawaii. G.I. Blues and Blue Hawaii were two pretty standard Paramount musicals. G.I. Blues takes place in Germany at an American station, and so it's just about basically Elvis kind of hanging out with some of his war buddies, trying to get girls.
Now, does that take place during the Korean War or during World War II?
It takes place during Nowhere whatsoever, really. It takes place during whatever Elvis was doing in Germany in 1960.
The war against the Beatles.
Exactly. Yeah, they're trying to go over to Hamburg to stop the Beatles from happening.
it was a bloody conflict. Bobby socks everywhere. You have no idea. Women just fainting in the aisles.
And then Blue Hawaii, it kind of has almost the exact same formula, except it takes place in a tropical location, which would become a staple for Elvis movies.
And that one has Angela Lansbury, right?
It does. As
his mother?
Yes.
Yeah, that's one I've actually seen a lot.
Yeah.
There are a few of these Elvis movies that I have seen like ad nauseum, and I don't know if that was just because they were my mom's favorites or if they were just on the most often. I want to go back for a second to King Creole, because one of the things that I really like about King Creole is the fact that it is, you know, it's got a little bit of like, you know, Elvis as the performer, but those things seem so secondary to this sort of dark film noir plot going on with Walter Matthau as this great like local New Orleans crime figure.
Yeah.
And I just, that's, you watch this movie and you're like, oh, this is what Elvis movies could have been if, you know, he hadn't been so micromanaged. And I think it's really important to see King Creole before really making any judgments about Elvis as a performer, because you might watch the movie and still think, oh, he's not that good. But I'm telling you, there is an intensity in that performance, and there is a dedication in that performance that I don't think we ever saw again. And I actually like Jailhouse Rock to a certain extent, and I feel like it flirts with what King Creole accomplished by making Elvis a sort of darker, more anti-hero, a darker sort of a guy at odds with society.
Yeah, and it's really in the films that took a chance on treating Elvis seriously that's where he really seemed to be most comfortable and really wanting to go as an artist, is to not just illustrate like a rock and roll persona as some sort of just, you know, playful rebellion for its own sake, but this real like masculine brooding that is lying under the surface. King Creole reminds me a lot of the Elia Kazan film, Face in the Crowd.
Huh.
With
Andy Griffith.
Andy Griffith.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can see that. There's definite a crossover for sure. And Elia Kazan, I mean, you want to talk about somebody who has worked, you know, worked extensively with James Dean. So, I mean, I feel like that crossover is a really natural thing. I mean, you have King Creole and Face in the Crowd kind of touching upon the same subjects, because they do kind of have this strange sort of shared parentage almost.
Yes. Yeah, they do. And in Wild in the Country, which is one of my personal favorites of his, I haven't gone through all of his movies. To be honest, it can get a bit difficult.
Well, there's a shit ton of them.
There's a lot of them. And really after 1962, it becomes harder and harder because during this period, there are these really interesting differences between these movies. And in Wild in the Country, what you have in a film like Wild in the Country, which is a film about this basically kind of wayward teenager who accidentally kills a man in a fight, and then he is attempted to be kind of saved and redeemed into society by a local psychologist. And it kind of covers the relationships with various women that he has while he tries to become an acceptable member of society.
Huh.
Not really a plot that lends itself to song and dance.
Not entirely, no.
And there's this one moment in the film where he is driving with his psychiatrist through to a hotel, and all of a sudden breaks out into song in the middle of his drive. There's no dance or anything like that. He just kind of turns to her. The sounds of instruments, you know, are evident from basically nowhere. You know, they're in a car.
Just wafting in on the breeze.
Absolutely, yeah. And he starts singing to her, and it is one of the strangest moments that I've ever seen in a film, because beyond the title song, up until that point, there is no singing from Elvis whatsoever. And so you see this kind of tension between, oh, we have the biggest rock star in the world in this movie, we need to make him sing, versus should we actually try to see what he can do as an actor?
So just go right for the singing and not even pay attention to the fact that, I mean, people like Michael Curtis and Walter Matthau and Robert Mitchum are all like, no, you need to give this kid a shot because he's actually a good actor. And yet, you know, kind of counter to all of this and the impediment almost is Tom Parker.
Yeah.
Is a guy who looks at Elvis as a come on. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this more and more, this relationship between Tom Parker and Elvis. And in contemporary cinema, the closest thing that I can think of that kind of mirrored that was this is going to sound really odd, but Taylor Lautner and his father.
Huh.
Taylor Lautner's father, this is all, these are things that I have I've heard behind the scenes, it was very much a very controlling, very forceful and you know, frankly a very arrogant man who saw his kid as the like the ultimate meal ticket and thought he was going to be a huge star and in fact was instrumental in the downfall of his son's career. Because the two of them together, I mean, with Taylor Lautner's dad kind of coming in and bullying various agents and like, you don't understand, this kid's going to be huge, you all work for me now, that kind of mentality. And when Abducted failed, it was like he tried to turn it around, but at that point he had burned so many bridges that they really couldn't get a foothold again. But I just keep imagining that if that movie had done as well as any of the Elvis movies would have continued, there would have been that, like, I can almost see Taylor Lautner's dad buying, you know, a white suit and a cowboy hat and just going full Tom Parker with it.
Yeah, as opposed to Robert Pattinson, who post-Twilight seems to have at least the freedom to say, no, instead of being a traditional movie star, I'm going to work. Or instead of being, you know, some skin on screen, I'm going to work with David Cronenberg and Olivier Assayas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
making some interesting choices, no doubt.
Yes. And Tom Parker did definitely have a kind of psychological stranglehold on Elvis. His role, according to biographers, this, you know, I'll just say, you know, it's often really difficult to disconnect history from the myth, but I think there is a lot of real substantive ground to the myth of Colonel Tom Parker as this kind of giant overbearing figure in Elvis's life, that Elvis perhaps didn't realize the power that he had as a movie star at this particular period of time, and he was literally exhausted by this process, making three movies a year.
Yeah, that would exhaust it. I mean, even Samuel L. Jackson would tell you that's an exhausting schedule.
I know, and these aren't walk-on roles either.
Yeah,
I
mean, no, these are starring vehicles for the guy.
Yeah, and to be drained artistically, to be drained musically, there's something to be said for the power of the formula, because one thing we need to recognize is that people are showing up to these movies.
Right.
A lot of people were showing up to these movies in droves, that it wasn't just Colonel Tom Parker, but it was the studios that were interested in renewing these contracts ad nauseum over and over and over again, even as rock and roll itself went through so many dramatic changes during the period of the 1960s in which he made the majority of his films.
Yeah, that is strange because, yeah, you're right. There gets to be a period where, you know, the Beatles come out, even when the Beatles come out, they're very pop, they're very much the kind of bubblegum stuff that Elvis is doing early on. But then they get wildly experimental in the years that Elvis movies are still playing upon, you know, the Elvis the Pelvis and, you know, the teen heartthrob. And Elvis as an artist is not really evolving that much. If you look strictly at the films, he's not evolving as an artist. He's just being kept in that same mode, even as you mentioned, like rock and roll is growing up around him.
Yeah, and even by the end of this period, by this 1968 comeback special on TV, while rock and roll has completely changed into this like vast countercultural form, into this investment in psychedelia and this investment in radical politics and things like that, there's this culture of nostalgia around Elvis, almost like he was this, especially for perhaps more conservative fans of rock and roll, that he was this some sort of pure figure.
Which is so bizarre when you think about how he started. He was this kid who was, you know, basically co-opting black music and corrupting our children, quote unquote. You know, these parents in the 50s so concerned about the way he moves his pelvis and the fact that he's bringing, you know, the black music into our house. Like, he was the epitome of counterculture. And then his movies seem to, like, trap him in this weird phantom zone of, like, pure bubblegum.
Yeah.
And he just stays there, even though, like, when he started, he was the epitome of counterculture.
Yeah, and you know, it's I tried to push back certain instincts that I had when reading about this, when starting this project, of feeling really sorry for Elvis, because Elvis was incredibly popular and incredibly successful at an art form that he did adapt from black people, mm-hmm. who were not as financially successful as
right.
him,
yeah.
because of cultural racism. But then,
true.
But then at the same time, when you see that even with somebody with the privilege of Elvis, still becomes trapped within the system, because the rock and roll is especially at this particular point in his career, less dominated by its ethos and more run by the dollar making mechanisms through which, you know, the people who don't perhaps actually listen to rock and roll,
right,
you know, actually see within it. And one important thing to remember, I think, in terms of looking at rock and roll film history as a whole, is that throughout this entire decade, beyond Elvis films, you know, rock and roll films are incredibly profitable. Whether or not it's a late 60s Elvis movie or the 4-hour Woodstock documentary.
Sure.
But there is an incredibly different kind of culture and kind of politics that's being presented in these types of films, even though they exist within the same cinematic time. Because we don't, you know, we as you alluded to before, we often think of Elvis as like this, you know, this emblem of the 1950s,
yeah.
versus the Beatles as these emblems of the mid 1960s, who then evolved through their career, and then you go on to Woodstock or the Band, and then glam, and then so on and so forth. But these things, we need to remember that these things coexisted, that these things kind of all existed at the same time, and that there were kind of multiple tiers of rock and roll that people chose from. Mm-hmm. And Elvis has a really strange role in this history, specifically because of the longevity and the you know, the incredible prolificness of his filmmaking throughout this period.
Right. So one of the things that I know that when I was talking to you before that really interested me was the movie Viva Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very significant movie for a couple of different reasons, not the least of which the year it came out happened to be the year another big musical rock and roll film came out.
Mm-hmm.
So, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, yeah. So, Viva Las Vegas came out the same year as Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
And both of these films, obviously, were massive successes. I told you the other day that Viva Las Vegas actually outgrossed Hard Day's Night in 1964. I went back and double-checked on that before this podcast, and it turns out I was wrong about that. So... I'm glad I never put that in writing.
It's like beta testing.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, we're fact-checking before you actually commit this to paper. Yeah.
But according to the most recent thing I looked at, Hard Day's Night was the number 9 highest-grossing movie in 1964. Viva Las Vegas was number 14.
Yeah.
Still, these are both you know, very, very big rock and roll movies that come out in the same year. Hard Day's Night was the Beatles' most successful film. And Viva Las Vegas was Elvis's most successful film. And, you know, the Beatles really wanted to make something that diverged from the Elvis formula in terms of aesthetics and everything like that, and choosing Richard Lester to make the film, and having this kind of crazy surreal humor to the film, and that it's not a flashy film. It's shot in the Academy ratio, it's black and white. Mm-hmm. It looks very handheld versus these like flashy CinemaScope, Technicolor films that Elvis was making.
Right.
But what's funny about that is that the kind of economic structure of these films is exactly the same. You have an album that corresponds with the film.
Right.
And that album is both the studio album of the band or musician. And it's also simultaneously the soundtrack to the film.
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny, though, like, when we're talking about what the Beatles were trying to do with, you know, crossing over into film and what Elvis is trying, I feel like these two films are the perfect, like, diametrically, it shows the diametric opposition of what they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like you said, the Beatles, they shoot in the Academy ratio, and they shoot black and white. The same year, Elvis releases Viva Las Vegas, that and you couldn't get a more colorful setting than the bright lights, you know, of Las Vegas and all of the splendor there contained. And it's just like these two movies really, I think, represent the two very different paths that the artists were on. I mean, and of course, this is the first film for the Beatles, and this is, I don't know, the 15th film for Elvis. quite a few into his career, but it represents, I think, such a crossroads for rock and roll cinema in general.
Yeah, and Elvis himself looks plastic in that movie. Literally looks plastic. Like, he looks like a Ken doll. He looks like he's been spray tan, and his hair, unlike his earlier films, his hair just looks like this kind of uniform coif that just kind of wraps around his head instead of something that, like, a human being would wake up in the morning and make.
It's like he looks like all of the characters in that first Blu-ray release of Predator.
Yeah.
Where it's like Arnold, for some reason, is completely made of molded plastic. It doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah, you can't have a more kind of divergent example of two different ideas of rock authenticity than Viva Las Vegas, which takes, as you point out, takes place in basically the most superficial city in our dear country, versus floppy hair and handheld cameras.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you're going through and you're watching these movies for your dissertation, obviously it's not all focused on Elvis, but no. I'm sure you've watched quite a few by now. Outside of maybe King Creole, what's been the one that surprised you the most? Whether you thought it was going to be maybe a step in the right direction, it turned out to be abysmal, or very much the opposite, perhaps.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of really interesting moments, I think, in all of these films. Like even one of his last films they made, Charo, which was this Western that he only did the title song for. Other than that, there's no music.
And he plays a bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he tried to present himself as more rugged. It was really this was his last year of filmmaking, of acting in films, but it was his kind of last call attempt to be this authentic, serious actor. And he let his facial hair grow out. He apparently the first drafts of the script were far more violent than the G-rated final cut ended up being. But these kind of tensions existed throughout his career, and he still, even after 13 years, wanted to be a serious actor. But I would say that the one film that really surprised me the most, because I was just kind of initially going through just to kind of get through this part of the filmography, but really shocked me, was the first film that he made with Paramount. So this is between Love Me Tender and Jailhouse Rock. It's a film called Loving You, in 1957 by Hal Cantor. And it's basically about the moral panic around rock and roll. On the surface of it, it's this juicy bubblegum kind of, you know, kind of film that really tries to assuage the fears of parents who are afraid that this guy who's swinging his crotch around is going to be in a movie theater. But what the film ends up being about is actually a trial within the small town that he resides in about whether or not the character that Elvis plays should be allowed to perform on their local television station.
So very much life or art imitating life.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow, yeah. I had no idea. And Hal Cantor is an interesting figure. More as a screenwriter known as than a director, but you know, it's so surprising to me as you go back through the catalog of Elvis films and see the various people that he worked with.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't all just part of a machine. It wasn't just, you know, get whatever hack you can to put this movie out as quickly as possible. Like, he worked with some true artists.
Mm-hmm, he did.
And that's really fascinating and surprising to me. I gotta check this one out. This seems like it would make a great double feature with something like Roger Corman's Rock All Night.
Yes.
Which is another film that's about just the fear of rock culture.
Yeah, of it manifesting as a form of real crime.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and you know, the movie that kind of started it all was Blackboard Jungle.
Yep.
1955 rather, that featured Bill Haley and his Comets, Rock Around the Clock, as its title song, as its ending song. And you know, there were actually riots in the United States and England by Teddy Boys and rockers who would go see that movie. Wow. And within the film itself, it's about, you know, the social menace of youth. And
right.
In some ways it's about, you know, fear of African American men. And And I think it's in terms of, you know, what you were talking about earlier of reminding ourselves that that 50s rock and roll was really an insurgent counterculture of its own, to think about how much of a threat it posed to social mores, how much Rebel Without a Cause, despite not being technically a rock and roll film, had to do with that culture that Elvis was very much a part of.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny, and rock and roll absolutely was this counterculture movement. It was something that had parents terrified. And then just not even a whole generation later, it's already becoming sort of, there's a reverence, a nostalgia that already starts to take hold. Mm. And we get shows like Happy Days.
Yes.
Less than a generation after what we're talking about,
yeah,
you get a show that almost fetishizes the 1950s and rock and roll culture. It makes the Fonz an irrepressible cool, a hero that everybody can love, obviously a very PG version of sort of the rock movement. But still, you know, less than a full generation later, our view of rock and roll completely changes.
Yeah, and I remember when I was a kid going to Cotillion, being, you know, forced how to learn to do the jitterbug and stuff like that, alongside like the foxtrot and more classical dances, like that it becomes this very, you know, it just becomes this kind of traditional part of history, but in a way that risks kind of stripping it of its politics and of its really potent force, and of the fact that, you know, it's not all hyperbolic to say that people considered this the devil's music, and that, you know, TV had just emerged as a major source of media directly within people's homes. And so to see somebody on television shaking their hips and playing electric guitar within the sacred private space of your own home, that was like a really, truly shocking thing for people to experience.
Sure. So before you started on this project, I mean, what was your – I mean, had you had a lot of exposure to Elvis at all, or – or was this just purely from an academic standpoint, something you were interested in?
Well, what really got me started on this project was trying to make sense of David Bowie's music career in starting in the mid-1970s, specifically around The Man Who Fell to Earth, The Hunger, and Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. I wanted to understand why this major rock star, or how this major rock star in his first few movies as a lead actor was able to perform in these movies without ever singing a song, without ever having a song of his featured. Yeah. And so
what was the attraction by these filmmakers to David Bowie if they weren't going to have him sing at all in the, I mean, even like when he does Labyrinth, he's singing all through Labyrinth, which is obviously much later, but you're right. That is an interesting, it's like, how did these filmmakers look at somebody like David Bowie and see him as a performer in the theatrical sense, as opposed to a performer in the musical sense?
Mm-hmm. And how much of, you know, and where do we see, like, where do we see music itself in terms of identifying somebody as a rock star? How much of that actually has to do with the music that they perform? And I love David Bowie's music, but I think in terms of his persona, there's a lot of extra musical performance that goes into his persona and his many changes in persona. So what I want to do from that standpoint was to go back and to ask what were the roles of rock stars in movies up until this period. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like, that's why I felt like the natural place to start would be Elvis, especially because he represents the complete opposite of what David Bowie was doing from the mid 70s to the early 1980s, in which he is kind of in this endless cycle in which his musical image is continually reinforced by his cinematic image and vice versa.
Interesting. So obviously, before we move on from this topic, is there anything about the Elvis film canon that we haven't touched on yet that you think is important to kind of developing an understanding of who Elvis was as an actor, or as an actor slash singer?
I guess two particular things I would say to keep in mind. He really became a movie star, a truly bankable movie star with Blue Hawaii, with the film that we mentioned earlier, which was his first gigantic hit.
Okay.
And the title of the film comes from a song featured in a Bing Crosby film from 1937 called Waikiki Wedding. It's a cover of that. And so
had no idea.
Yeah. So what you see there at that particular point in time is these movie studios realizing that if they can connect the song to the persona in a particular way, this formula develops. And that's how the Elvis formula really took hold at that point in time. But even then, after that, his movies continue to be interesting. You know, 1972, there's this documentary he's in called Elvis on Tour, which is just basically his return to live performance late in his career, you know, with the giant crazy suit and you know, coming out to the Thus Spoke Zarathustra.
Yep, and, yep, of course.
And just crazy over the top Elvis. But Martin Scorsese actually was a co-editor on that film, and he co-edited that film in a way similar to the way that he worked on Woodstock, in which he would have this kind of split screen thing happening all the time, in which you'd have, as a movie viewer, an omniscient experience of this musical performance.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is so interesting about that is that basically you have in this incredible career on screen, you have so many different versions of the rock and roll movie kind of seen and exercised through this one cultural figure, even into a movie that uses some of the same kind of radical filmmaking techniques that Woodstock did.
Right.
And that really complicates, I think, our view of Elvis as either a homogenous figure or even as a conservative figure politically or culturally or artistically speaking. It's easy to go back and see his movies as just one big block of excuses to sing, but his movies are, I think, far more interesting and more complicated than that.
And it's so fitting that, you know, a movie like Woodstock takes so many risks and does so many things when it's cataloging a period in history where everything was changing. And, mm-hmm. and it was just such a nouveau way of thinking across the board, and it's interesting to me that this Elvis documentary you mentioned is edited sort of in that same way, because you are talking about a figure who started off his career changing everything. Yeah. You know, the argument, of course, for better or worse, rages on and on, but he is a figure, you know, without whom the history of pop culture entirely would have been very different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fascinating. I mean, I think the films are an extension of that.
One thing that I would like to do, I guess, as we begin to wind down a bit, is to kind of give some credence, though, to the point that, you know, some of the movies that Elvis made are really truly interchangeable and do kind of follow a formula.
Okay.
Except perhaps with Harum Scarum, which had the movie gone according exactly to Colonel Tom Parker's wishes, would have had a talking camel at one point.
What?
Yes.
Seriously?
Yes. That is the disconnect between Colonel Tom Parker and rock and roll right there.
So I mean, would that have made the movie better or worse? Like, I think it would have
made the movie watchable.
And for no reason, a talking camel, ladies and gentlemen.
I certainly think there is, you know, there is value to the notion, especially around the mid 1960s, that he was in he might have felt artistically stagnant. But what I would like to do is to list off a couple of the names of the characters that Elvis plays in some of his films,
because
we never, you know, we never think of him as anything but Elvis on screen. Yet in all of these films, people manage to come up with, you know, 31 different names for who Elvis's character is going to be. So I've got a few choice ones that I picked out here, and I'm just going to rattle them off.
Do it.
Okay, Guy Lambert. Joe Lightcloud.
Wait, is he a Native American in that film?
I forget which film it's part of. it might have been Flaming Star, in which he played someone who was half Native American,
okay,
half white.
Well, that would at least make sense.
Yeah, but Joe still. Rick Richards.
who sounds like the kind of guy who would host a late night, like, all right, kids, it's time Rick for Richard. Rick Richards Rock and Roll Review.
these sound like the names of the characters that I developed in some very ill-advised first scripts that I tried to make as a kid. And I was just like, what are people's names? What would people's names be?
Joe Lightcloud is apparently from Stay Away Joe.
Oh, okay.
So not a Native American at all,
I guess. Here's a good one. These names also kind of, I think, perfectly encapsulate, even though this is decades before, some of these names, I think, kind of perfectly encapsulate bro culture. So I'll keep going. Chad Gates.
Chad Gates, sure.
Pacer Burton.
I'm pretty sure that's a Marvel superhero, but yeah, okay.
Tulsa McLean.
That's no one's name. That's not a human name. Tulsa McLean.
You can tell he's Southern because his name is Tulsa.
Ah, yeah. See how that works?
Yeah. Jimmy Topkins.
Okay.
Johnny Tyrone.
I think I got in a knife fight with that guy.
Rusty Wells.
I think that's a sex act. Yes. I think that's something you actually have to pay extra for.
Mike Edwards.
Okay.
Just which sounds like a politician who ran for a local election and lost.
Right.
Mike Windgren. So
sure.
Yeah. All the different mics. And my favorite, Dr. John Carpenter.
Ah, Dr. John Carpenter. That's nice. I like that one a lot.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I keep going back and forth. Joe Lightcloud is actually a half-breed Native American, according to the plot synopsis of Stay Away Joe. So
okay.
I was like, it has to be. They couldn't have just thrown that name at him.
Yeah.
I mean, they threw the name at him, but it has to at least be based on something.
Yes. So he might have reprised a version of his character from Flaming Star. So not at all interchangeable, because as you can see, they all have different names.
Point made, Dr. Palmer.
thesis done.
Thesis done. We're going to close out the show like we always do, talking about, of course, the junk food pairing. And it's impossible for the junk food pairing of this show to not be a fried peanut butter, banana, and bacon sandwich. Has your research gotten to the area of Elvis's dietary proclivities?
Not quite. And as much, and
as they milk, you know what? At your thesis defense, they may grill you on this, or they may fry you. I don't know. I guess they prefer fried.
Yeah.
But apparently, he had a fondness for greasy food, which is not hard to believe as you look at him later in life, unfortunately. But the controversy here is that not all accounts of his snacking habits mention bacon in the fried peanut butter banana sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I thought it was just peanut butter and bananas.
Yeah, it's something that's gone back and forth. But apparently, Elvis Presley's mother at one point, Gladys Presley, mentioned that sandwiches were his favorite, especially peanut butter, sliced bananas, and crisp bacon. So I think that's kind of where it got added in, and it's a staple of the Elvis diet. I've never had one myself because as much as I love bacon, the thought of mixing it with peanut butter. I don't know. I can't reconcile those two tastes, but it could be the greatest thing in the world. So I may have one just in honor of the king and in honor of this. Have you ever had one?
I'm vegetarian, so unfortunately I cannot.
What about the version with just peanut butter and banana and fried?
Yeah.
That's healthy, right?
Well, I have to get protein somewhere, so.
Fried peanut butter.
Yeah, I will say my dog loves that meal as well.
There you go. Fried gold. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoes. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, guys, thank you so much. That's going to do it for Junk Food Cinema this week. I want to thank our very special guest, Mr. Landon Palmer. Is there anything in particular that you would like to pimp or tell people where they can find you online, et cetera, et cetera?
Follow me at @LandonSpeak. I am the crying Ninja Turtle there. and check back at Film School Rejects every Tuesday for each entry in my column, Culture Warrior.
Hey, Tuesday is also the day of the week that Junk Food Cinema is released. Ah, simpatico. I love that. And I also love the fact that you write these really intense, in-depth articles, and I maintain to this day, and I'm not just blowing smoke, that they are some of the smartest commentaries on film anywhere online, anywhere that you can read. Definitely check that out. But I love the fact that you go into all of this intellectual weight of all of these various topics, and your Twitter icon is a crying Ninja Turtle. I have always loved, like, you are not a pretentious person by any stretch of the imagination. And clearly that movie affected you as much as it did me.
Well, it's actually from a Barbara Walters interview during the promotion of the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. And they have Barbara Walters interviewing all four of the turtles.
Oh,
and then Donatello starts crying. And I'll link to the video on the
please,
on the
please
thing.
God do.
Because it is you can't tell from the screen grab that I use as my avatar, but it is watching Donatello cry, and you know this person in this animatronic suit with this water just like squirting out of the suit, it's one of the more disturbing things.
Especially when you consider them the first Ninja Turtles, Donatello was Corey Feldman.
Yes.
So it's just, it's Corey Feldman breaking down, like, basically masking his true pain and his true addiction, and just, like, via the suit, allowed to kind of have this cathartic moment. And suddenly, the entire course of that Ninja Turtles film is different and has this other layer to it that nobody was expecting.
I'm hoping for that moment to occur in the Michael Bay.
Yeah, right? Moment. It just breaks down crying. Yeah. Damn it, Corey Feldman. I'll remind you guys once again, you can find Junk Food Cinema on iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can also follow me at Bri Guy Salisbury, or you can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. And please do use those Amazon links and tell your friends about the show. We would really appreciate that. But until next time, I'm just going to close out by saying, and I'll put in something later because I didn't write anything.